This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a Labor Day special program.
Typically, an employer hears that somebody used the N-word at the workplace and that employee is gone. And there are serious consequences and there's training and there's all of this stuff. And Tesla's had hundreds and hundreds of instances day in, day out for years with no correction.
10,000 black workers are likely to sue Elon Musk at the Fremont Tesla plant for systemic racism and harassment on the job.
These nonprofits are essentially a way to dismantle the state and at the same time lower taxes on the wealthy because they can deliver the same services or less services through nonprofits that essentially are exploiting their workers.
Labor historian Robert Ovetz discusses nonprofits' privatization and the history of class struggle in America.
They were using dynamic brake on this thing to save brake shoes in this derailment. For what that derailment cost them, they could have filled up the whole state of Ohio with brake shoes. The railroads had captured our government.
Did the National Transportation Safety Board cover up Norfolk Southern's criminal liability in the East Palestine Trail derailment?
In months, SF State has divested from entities responsible for this genocide, and imagine the power that we hold as a community.
Students and faculty at the San Francisco State University continue to fight for Palestine. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Black workers at Elon Musk's Fremont Tesla auto factory have won the right to sue Musk and Tesla for systemic racism and harassment on the job. I spoke with Brian Schwartz, who is the Oakland lawyer representing this class action suit against Musk and his company, Tesla, in Fremont. Brian, why don't you talk about what's going on this Labor Day weekend and the issue of black workers at the Tesla Fremont plant that you're representing?
The racism at this futuristic Silicon Valley plant is shocking and archaic. The N-word and other horrific racist epithets and graffiti like swastikas and KKK symbols and other things of that nature are a constant presence in the Tesla Fremont factory. And so since 2017, we've had this class action pending on behalf of the black workers there. Once we realized that this was a common pattern and practice there in the factory that needed to be addressed, and Tesla has been fighting the lawsuit instead of improving the situation with scorched earth tactics, and the workers continue to suffer, but we have been making progress little by little. We've beaten multiple appeals by Tesla to the Court of Appeal, trying to sweep our lawsuit under the rug with arguments relating to side issues like arbitration. And finally, after six rounds of briefing and multiple oral arguments, we certified a class, which we expect to be, could be around 10,000 black workers at the factory from 2016 to the present, to challenge the ongoing severe and pervasive racism that's happening there.
And Elon Musk apparently is spending a lot of money on lawyers fighting you and other workers around health and safety, around union organizing. But it seems like there's a systemic effort to prevent really changing the conditions of black workers at the plant. Did your clients try to change the culture at the plant? I know some workers have said it was like working in a plantation to work at the Fremont plant.
Yeah, plantation and slave ship are some of the terms that the workers themselves frequently use to refer to the factory and the way that black workers are treated there. I don't think that the workers have been empowered to change things, which is why they had to resort to the lawsuit. But the good news is that hundreds and hundreds of the workers are stepping forward in the lawsuit as witnesses and to pursue their own claims for damages after we establish some of the common factual findings that will relate to liability.
And what are the kind of conditions, or the health conditions, mental health conditions that happen when workers are tormented, apparently uncontrolled by management at the Fremont plant? I mean, it seems like it'd have a heavy weight on their health, mental health.
It sure does. The workers keep going to work because it's a relatively well-paying job, which doesn't require a lot of qualifications. It's the only, you know, big auto plant here locally. And I think a lot of the workers initially are interested in the technology, interested in the idea of working for an electric car company, but, you know, are quickly disappointed when they arrive and see that workers are treated so horribly and with this incredible, abundant, unlawful racism happening in the factory. So it's devastating, and some people suffer there for quite a while because they got bills to pay, and it's not that easy to replace the job. If you are working at the Tesla factory and the wages are good and you know there's benefits and so forth, and your alternative is to go work in some kind of, you know, fast food situation or retail, it's tough. If you've got, you know, kids in school, medical bills, car payments, Bay Area rents or mortgage. So it puts the workers in a bind, and it's very hard for them mentally and emotionally to have to go through that and have to endure that kind of treatment just to want to make a living. There was a lot of evidence about it in the Owen Diaz trial. That was one worker. You know, our case might involve 10,000, but that was just one of the workers who was there 9 months and talked about, you know, devastating emotional distress. He wound up initially winning a jury verdict of $136.9 million. The judge reduced it, and then they had to retry the case, and they wound up getting $3.2 million. But it was the reason that he was awarded millions of dollars was because of the kinds of emotional distress that he suffered, the anxiety, the sleepless nights, the impact on relationships with people around you, the impacts on your appetite, on your general well-being, your ability to function.
And when you talk about 10,000 workers at the Tesla Fremont plant, that seems like a pretty large class of workers, a number of workers that have been affected by this.
Yeah, it's massive. We think it's the largest harassment class action ever certified in anywhere in the country.
And what has been the role of government agencies in California, EEOC? And it seems that there are a lot of government agencies which have a responsibility to do oversight of these issues of racial discrimination. What's happened with that? Are they doing their job? Are they supporting your efforts? What's happening with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So this is the only case that I know of where not only do we have our huge class action, but then subsequently, a number of years later, the state agency filed its own case. And then years after that, the federal government filed its own case. So now there's these three different actions all addressing and corroborating the terrible racism toward Black workers at the Fremont factory.
Now, you're filing for compensation for these workers who've been facing racial harassment, discrimination on the job. Do you think that there should be other penalties, criminal penalties? Because it seems that Elon Musk's arrogance is that he really thinks he can get away with this and has been getting away with this for years.
It's true that they've been getting away with it for years. Hopefully they won't be getting away with it much longer. First phase of our lawsuit is to obtain a public injunction to try to change the company's practices and force the company to reform. And then the second phase, after that first phase, there'll be individual trials on damages for all the people who will file damages complaints. And, you know, we expect a very large number of people with those individual complaints. And the juries hearing those damages complaints will have the opportunity to award punitive damages. So that's the way that businesses and employers are penalized. There's no criminal aspect of the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which is the statute that's at issue in our case. There may be other criminal issues out there involving this employer, but that's not what our case is about.
Now, if this is a non-union factory and Elon Musk has said, along with Trump, that he doesn't want to have unions. There were 700 workers who were fired at the Fremont plant in 2017. Many of those were trying to have a union, the UAW. You think it would have made any difference at all as far as the treatment of the workers if there had been a union there?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, my theory, because it's almost inexplicable how a major employer, modern major employer that is even vaguely economically rational, would continue to permit such egregious harassment to happen at the factory. And the only explanation that makes any sense that I've come up with, beyond just the arrogance of Elon Musk, is that they've decided that it actually benefits them to have divisions at the factory and to foment this kind of racist environment to keep the workers from coming together, because when the workers come together, it actually costs them more than they feel like they might wind up paying in our many lawsuits. To answer your question, absolutely, the unions help secure rights and better compensation and benefits for workers typically, and they are attempting at all costs to keep that from happening. And I think it's the only theory I've come up with as to how they could possibly allow this kind of race harassment to endure there for so many years. I mean, typically an employer hears that somebody used the N-word at the workplace and that employee is gone, and there are serious consequences and there's training and there's all of this stuff. And Tesla's had hundreds and hundreds of instances day in, day out for years with no correction. So unless they're just profoundly stupid, which I don't think is probably the most likely explanation, they seem to have decided to foster this kind of division which the racism is part of.
And we're 2024, Labor Day commemoration, or the next week. What does it say about California and America that you have this kind of blatant, systemic racism against workers at a large facility in California in the United States?
It says that we still have a long way to go.
That was employment lawyer Brian Schwartz talking about the 10,000 black workers who will be suing Elon Musk and his company Tesla for systemic racism at the Fremont Tesla plant.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But when they're long, get ready, you got to move.
That was Mississippi Fred McDowell, You Gotta Move. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. In a wide-ranging discussion of nonprofits and privatization and the history of the struggle between American workers, capitalists, and their government, labor historian and political scientist Robert Ovitz spoke to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke.
Robert Ovitz, a PhD, is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at San Jose State University, whose research focuses on strike threats and labor movements in the United States. He has published books on the U.S. Constitution, the politics of the labor movement, and the crisis of capitalism at the turn of the 20th century. He worked in the Texas State Legislature and as a public policy advocate, and his doctoral degree was earned at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Ovitz, though it is my first time to speak to you, please welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Thanks, Thomas.
Good. Let's start with this, a recent article you wrote about the nonprofits industry in the United States. How do contemporary American capitalists use the governmental tax code to create 501c3 nonprofits, there are others, as a tactic or method to privatize public services and cut and diminish working conditions for those service workers and their publics?
Wow, I'm writing a whole book about that. The final version will be out in 2025 with Haymarket Press. So it's a long history, and the short of it is that about a century ago, particularly with the passage of the Income Tax Amendment to the Constitution, the Congress started constructing parts of the tax code that allowed for tax deductions and tax exemptions. And this ultimately evolved into what we call 501c3s, of which there's around 20 different types of nonprofits. Most of them are really, really small, but there are many very large ones, and most of them are funded by foundations or by government contracts for services. And so those that are funded by government contracts for services often are delivering various things that used to be delivered by primarily unionized, well-paid, securely employed public sector workers who often had pensions and things like paid vacation and sick leave and so forth. This all really was experimented in the 1950s and 60s, particularly by Ford, which really created this model by which public services would be externalized or outsourced or privatized, whatever term you prefer, by having government fund the delivery of those services. And the most famous model for that is a little remembered network of nonprofits entirely set up by Ford, with its models in New York City called Mobilization for Youth. And they essentially delivered various services to people who were either denied or didn't receive any social welfare benefits. And they provided things like legal services and so forth. This became the model that's now widespread, particularly after the 1969 Tax Reform Act, which led to a vast expansion of the nonprofit sector. The number of foundations grew, the total assets of foundations accelerated, and then the number of nonprofits and its share of the U.S. labor force exploded. And just to give you a kind of bare bones example, is that these nonprofits have become such a large adjunct of government that in some cities, like in New York, a lot of people don't realize this. New York's supposed to be a labor-friendly, you know, it's a labor town, right? It's supposed to be labor-friendly government and so forth. There's actually more nonprofit workers in New York City than there are public sector workers working for the city, one of the largest cities in the country. So it's been so privatized under the noses of unions. And in many cases, the unions are going along with it because they think they can unionize those nonprofit workers, which they haven't done for decades until, and I'll talk about this in the last few years, there's been an explosion of nonprofit unionization and strikes, including in New York City. And but the reality is that these nonprofits are essentially a way to dismantle the state and at the same time lower taxes on the wealthy because they can deliver the same services or less services through nonprofits that essentially are exploiting their workers viciously. I used to be a nonprofit worker for many years. I worked for NGOs, which I can talk about later, but it's widely known nonprofit workers are paid terribly. They have long work days, work hours, work lives. There's a lot of turnover, a lot of burnout. And so nonprofits are able to use the guilt-driven mission, carrying out the mission, to really super exploit their workers in a way that would not happen if they were unionized public sector workers.
Your example or your zeroing in on New York City made me immediately think of the time of the Clinton administration and his attack on welfare as we know it, and how it was attacked with one angle being that eliminating unionized jobs, cleaning the metro system, for example, and things like that. Another example that comes to mind after seeing something recently about the for-profit prison industry that has burgeoned and has been a thorn in the side of labor throughout its history. But your article that I referred to earlier compared all the nonprofits in the country to Amazon with a $1.5 trillion gross product put out by both sides, but with the nonprofits employing maybe six times as many people.
That's right. So
Go ahead. Go
we
ahead.
underestimate just how much of the economy nonprofits are. And that was just a little experiment at the time to compare the world's largest corporation to the nonprofit sector. Amazon's gotten bigger since then at a faster rate than nonprofits. But we tend to overlook nonprofits. And one reason for that is because they're couched in this mythology that they're doing, you know, good work, that they're serving the public, that they're serving people who are in need. But what we don't realize is that these are things that used to be provided by government. And now they're provided essentially by organizations that were set up by foundations. And I want to be clear, foundations are without exception. These are essentially ways that the super wealthy can launder their money tax-free to direct changes in policies and laws. So foundations are institutions of essentially the ruling class. And by Ford's model, we don't realize how significant Ford is. And I could go into Ford in many other ways. It's involvement in the labor movement. It's involvement in the left press, for example. But Ford created this model that's still with us. And it was intentional. It was a way to channel away public resources to reduce the cost, which reduces the tax burden. And it was also a way to legitimize the exploitation of a large segment of the labor force, essentially by exempting them from ordinary labor protections, and particularly unionization, which is now starting to change in the last few years.
And speaking to your sort of supporting the idea that these foundations disguise their real mission, was it Ford or Rockefeller that funded Alfred Kinsey and his revolutionary sexual research that opened many Americans' eyes post-World War II, but when it started to touch on interracial or anything that was deemed abnormal, it was quickly sort of dismissed or defunded. He died sort of an early death from heart disease, but he's his Kinsey Institute, I think, remains in Bloomington, Indiana today, right? University of Indiana.
Yeah, I last time checked, it's still around. Kinsey was funded by Rockefeller, you're correct.
It was Rockefeller, yeah, yeah, okay.
And that was an interesting twist because around the same time, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford, and others were funding birth control programs in the global South as a way to try to constrict the population of the global South because they were worried about growing population would lead to political instability and revolutionary movements. And it was a way to try to dampen that. And that grew out of the eugenics movement. There's a direct line in which Rockefeller was funding eugenicist groups for decades prior to that, as well as the founder of Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger.
Sure. Explain the roles of Democrats and Republicans, especially when they're unified, bipartisan unity being something I think many of us should be wary of, in using nonprofits as a cloaking mechanism to obscure the real workings of capitalism. How do you think this is a bipartisan project, in other words?
Well, I think you touched on it with the so-called welfare reform of the 90s that was carried out by Democrats in partnership, by the way, with Dick Gephardt's majority, which was kind of a pre-Trumpian plan, a 2025 plan to restructure and privatize government. And the Democrats went along with it. So this is it's a bipartisan effort.
Was that Newt Gingrich as well? Contract for America?
Newt Gingrich, sorry.
Or on America. Well, Gephardt was his...
Majority leader, yeah.
Majority across the aisle, but,
Right. Gephardt and Gingrich collaborated on all that.
Sure.
And so one thing I teach my students when we talk about the differences between Democrats and Republicans is that they really attempt to create what are called wedge issues to distinguish between themselves. And these tend to be around social issues, around issues of labor, of civil rights, immigration, gun control, all the wedge issues that we're hearing so much about right now. And there's real distinctions between them, for the most part, on those issues. But when it comes down to the economics of capitalism, there's a unity, and that's not really well recognized. That fundamentally, they are both parties whose objective is to manage and run the capitalist economy domestically and globally in an effective way. They just have a little bit of a different way to go about doing it. Democrats would like to rely more on regulatory measures to try to keep them in bounds, to have government as a kind of referee or an umpire. And Republicans would like, you know, corporations, for example, to just be self-regulated and to use the courts, you know, if they violate your property rights. But fundamentally, they're both parties whose objective, because at election time, like right now, they're very concerned that, you know, if unemployment goes up, interest rates go up, and so forth, the economy slows down, that they'll lose re-election. So fundamentally, they both have to make sure that capitalism just keeps humming along. And the point that I make is that they look divided, but they're in agreement on the most important thing in our capitalist economy, and that is protecting capitalism and making sure that it works. And so when both parties talk about the Constitution, what a lot of people don't realize is that, or liberty, as Republicans like to say, or Democrats, opportunity, those are their key catchwords, their mottos, if you will, is that what a lot of people don't realize is that much of the Constitution is not about rights for people, it's about rights for property. And that came about, and this is what I talk about in my last solo book, We the Elites, is that in response to the kind of upwelling of self-organized movements during the revolutionary era by slaves, by native peoples, by small farmers, there was a real threat to the emergence of capitalism and during the American Revolution. And so the outcome was to construct a new system under the Constitution that would be able to protect property and be able to suppress those kinds of movements for economic democracy. And so the two parties really maintain this agreement that they both need to manage capitalism, but they just do it in a different way.
This is Labor Day weekend, 2024. Please weigh in on the debate between International Workers' Day, which is May 1 around the world, though based on American labor history and began sometime in the early 20th century, versus U.S.'s National Labor Day designated to occur three, really, I counted it up again, it was more like a 120-day cooling off period. The difference between those two dates as an International Workers' Holiday, and then your opinion of the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act of 1935, describe it legally and within the context of the Great Depression.
Yeah, two,
that's a lot. I know.
Yeah, two interrelated questions. So starting with Labor Day, so happy Labor Day weekend to everybody if you're hearing this during the Labor Day weekend. But the reality is that this is not a day for or by workers. This was a day that was established through a declaration by President Grover Cleveland. And Cleveland, who served two non-consecutive terms, was a conservative pro-business president. And he could see that the industrial working class was starting to organize industrially and engage in very disruptive strikes. Cleveland set up this day, like you said, months after the rest of the world celebrates International Workers' Day on May 1st, which actually ties back to the old pagan ritual of the May Day ritual. And the May Day, you know, short history is that it was identified as part of the 1886 general strike calling for essentially 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, and 8 hours as you will. And also inspired by the great strike that led to the Haymarket slaughter, which I'll tie back into nonprofits in just a moment.
Come to Chicago, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tie it back into the National Labor Relations Act in just a moment, because there is a connection between the two. So while the rest of the world celebrates May 1st, we celebrate that first Monday in September. But the reality is that every day is really International Workers' Day. And that's because we have a global capitalist system which runs on the exploitation of labor. And so I have the same feelings about Labor Day, May Day, as I do about Father's Day or Mother's Day, that it should be every day. Right. So your second part of your question, the National Labor Relations Act, can be traced back to that general strike of 1886. There's a direct connection, and that's something that I really wrote about in my first book, When Workers Shot Back. That was essentially, we went through a period of about five decades of increasingly conflictual class struggles in which the industrial working class was starting to organize and capital responded with brutal, vicious violence using militias and police and private thugs. And ultimately, a kind of wing of the ruling class emerges around the turn of the century that sees particularly the Canadian model of labor relations as a way to restore control and be able to manage this conflict and channel it through collective bargaining. And although the National Labor Relations Act won't come about until the mid-1930s, during World War I, the corporatist Democratic President Wilson was facing a wave of wildcat strikes, which I wrote about in that book, in the arms sector particularly, as well as the Wobblies out, particularly in the West Coast. But in the East Coast, a lot of people don't realize that there were almost daily strikes, self-organized strikes by workers in the war industry, making uniforms and munitions and so forth. And they disrupted the war effort. And so the Wilson administration constructed a kind of proto-labor relations system that really informed first the National Recovery Act and then the National Labor Relations Act after the section of the NRA was thrown out by the Supreme Court. What a lot of people don't realize about the National Labor Relations Act, and this is a big chunk of what I write about in my book on NGOs and the labor movement and capitalism that's coming out in 2025, is that the National Labor Relations Act didn't just come out of the mind of Senator Wagner. It was actually written in partnership with a foundation called the Century Foundation, which is still around today. The Century Foundation is considered a pro-labor foundation. But in fact, it was set up by a wealthy department store magnate by the name of Feline. And until a few decades ago, there were still Feline department stores. He was viciously anti-union. He had a yellow union. He did not allow independent unions in his department store. But he set up this foundation as a way to try to create a way to manage class struggle. And the Century Foundation was integrated into Wagner's effort to write the National Labor Relations Act. There was a revolving door between his staff and the foundation. And it's very likely that much of the foundation wrote the National Labor Relations Act. I'm working my way through the archive, some of the archival documents from that period right now. And so there was a lot of coordination between the two. Now, essentially what the National Labor Relations Act does is, while it grants the first federal right of workers to engage in concerted activity, you know, organized struggle up to and including strikes, it's through a highly regulated and managed bureaucratic process, which is almost impossible to overcome today. And the result is that if unions want to be able to be a legal political actor in the economic system, they have to abide by labor law. And essentially, the short of it is that I see labor law as a harness on workers' ability to organize and struggle and to democratize this economy and get us past this, what the Secretary General calls a suicide pact of humanity. And that is, I would say, is capitalism. That capitalism is leading to the ultimate destruction of this planet sooner than later. And in order for us to do that, we have to go outside of labor law, because labor law essentially puts roadblocks and impediments in the way of workers being able to not only organize to improve our working conditions and have control over our work, but to be able to get us past capitalism.
That was labor historian and political science Professor Robert Ovitz speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke for this Labor Day exclusive.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh,
War on the Workers by Ann Feeney. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. In February of last year, the major Norfolk Southern train derailment took place in East Palestine, Ohio. The company ignited vinyl chloride to get the trains going quickly after the derailment. Now the National Transportation Safety Board has issued a 200-page report on the incident. Retired Iowa Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers trainman legislative rep Jeff Kurtz, who is also a health and safety expert, has looked at this report and discovered that the NTSB failed to report that braking issues contributed to the derailment. Kurtz has said that Norfolk Southern told engineers not to use air brakes on these incidents in order to save money on train brakes. Kurtz talked with Pacifica about this incident and why the accident could have been avoided.
My name's Jeff Kurtz. I started railroading back in 1974. My grandfather was a Santa Fe conductor for 32 years. My dad was a locomotive engineer for the Santa Fe for 37 years. And I completed my service in 2014 after a little over 40 years. And in that time, I was a union officer most of that time. The last few years between 2004 and 2014, I was the Iowa State Legislative Board Chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, part of the Teamsters, as a vice chairman on our national board, too. It was called a National Association of State Legislative Board Chairmen. What I would like to talk about is the NTSB report that came out. And when I was the state chairman here, I had to read these things all the time. The NTSB, the Federal Railroad Administration stuff I had to read, and I had to pretty well tear it apart. And what I found is I was going through this stuff is that there were always a lot of inaccuracies. There were a lot of stuff left out. The NTSB report itself is going to be a lot bigger than 13 pages, and it was 212 pages. So I thought, well, before I make any judgment, I want to see the whole thing come out. And so the 212 pages came out, and it was worse than the abstract. When it was coming into East Palestine, from what I understand, from what I read, they said they contacted the crew and they said, you've got the hot bearing desk says you have a hot bearing 23 cars back, I believe it was. They wanted these guys to stop. So, but instead of using the braking system on the cars, they used what we call the dynamic brake on the locomotives, because that saves brake shoes. It saves money. The braking on these locomotives for these 121 cars and, let me see, 18,000 tons was roughly 0.7 horsepower per ton. If, like I said, if I'm being generous, using a dynamic brake with this thing going 43 miles an hour, like it was, 18,000 tons going 43 miles an hour would be the equivalent braking power as if I was running this locomotive and all of a sudden I decided to stick my foot out the window and drag it in the ballast. That's about what the braking power is like. And when I saw that, I'm like, why aren't they using the air brake on the train? Well, and this is something that was never, ever mentioned in this report. They don't do that because of cost. You know, it's much more efficient and you'll have less slack action using the braking power. Because now when you, if they would have called this engineer and told him, look, you know, you need to stop your train. You've got a hot bearing 23 cars back. If he would have grabbed the air right away, which is what I would have done, he would start setting the brakes on each one of these cars. So it was, as it was slowing down, it would slow down in one unit, because that's ideally, as an engineer, you either want your slack stretched or you want it bunched. Instead, what they did, and this is probably because it's in his air brake and train handling rules, is he used the dynamic on these cars, that little bit of braking. So what happens is these cars, these 150 cars, are rolling free. I mean, the locomotives are braking, and dynamic brake, if you live near a railroad, you probably heard it whining. These things, I'm sure, were really, really whining. But they're braking, but the rest of the stuff, a train that's 9,300 feet long is going uphill and downhill at the same time. It's going around curves at a time when a lot of the train is going straight. So these cars are just going back and forth, and the train is not slowing down. And one thing that when I read the report, it said something about the engineer was going 43 miles an hour, and it looked like there was some time there between when he was called and when the derailment happened. Well, they've got all this slack bouncing around. All of a sudden, the wheel falls off the 23rd car, and this stuff starts running into each other at 40 miles an hour. You've got 18,000 tons just all over. That's why these cars go cattywampus like they do. You know, you look at how they stack up. They stack up because these trains are so big and they're so heavy. And it's just so hard to stop them. And then you put restrictions on these guys like, hey, you can't use the air. You know, we want to save money. So use your dynamic brake. And then when something like this happens, it's like, oh, God, we don't know what happened. We just have no idea. The moral of this all is, for one thing, don't run 2-mile-long trains. Don't run 3-mile-long trains. You cannot control them. Because even if you're not braking, what happens to these in-train forces with the slack? It's still there. So you don't take that chance. In fact, I was talking to a guy a couple of weeks ago about a train that broke in two several times, and they weren't even braking because it was 16,000 feet long, which is a little over 3 miles long, that they set it up for. They should have length limits and weight restrictions on these trains. There's no reason not to. They can still make plenty of money. You know, the fact that they were using dynamic brake on this thing to save brake shoes in this derailment, for what that derailment cost them, they could have filled up the whole state of Ohio with brake shoes. But they don't look at it that way. They look at the short-term cost. But the thing is, the NTSB had nothing about that in this report. They had nothing about, in fact, they talked very little about the derailment themselves. It was about the tank car types and everything. There should be something in there about a corporate death penalty. When you're this irresponsible and you do such stupid things like this, you take that corporation over. But, you know, they gloss that over in the report. And I'm thinking, this is, you know, the important things they just left out of here. If that engineer would have taken that train in the ditch at 70 miles an hour, he'd be in jail for the rest of his life.
Absolutely.
But now, because, oh, we don't know what happened. Well, I mean, my gosh, this is a mystery to us. Nobody's going to be penalized. There should be jail time in there. You throw Alan Shaw in jail for the next 5 years, that's going to wake some of these CEOs up. And then I think there, another thing I talked about, there should be something in there about a corporate death penalty. When you're this irresponsible and you do such stupid things like this, you take that corporation over, dissolve the assets, and they should use the assets of the NS to do it. And they should do that instead of protecting predators like the NS. One of the things, and the NTSB admitted this, that Norfolk Southern and Norfolk Southern, they referred to themselves as the Nazi Southern. It's because of the way they enforce the rules. And one of the things that the NTSB said, and they actually said this on tape, is they said NS corporate officers were threatening them. I would love you to go to something like this, stand up, and threaten people like that. You'd be in jail. But all they did was whine about it. It makes me crazy. My guys still call me up because they know when we do things like this, they're so afraid of the whistleblower stuff that they don't want to be seen in public. In fact, you know, that we had contacted several people about coming to this, current railroaders, and they would love to do it, but they know that BNSF will go after them if they do. Well, the railroads have captured our government.
That was BLET Railroad Iowa legislative rep and safety expert Jeff Kurtz on the cover-up by the National Transportation Safety Board on the braking issues in the East Palestine derailment. Residents and railway workers will be going to the EPA and Department of Transportation on October 4th in Washington, D.C. to demand that residents get health care and that safety rules be enforced to stop future derailments, as there have been over 1,500 more since the East Palestine catastrophe. The action is sponsored by Justice for East Palestine Residents and Workers.
It was a cold winter night, East Palestine. The moon was bright, stars could be seen. A working class rural East Ohio town had no idea what was about to go down. Then it boomed like a bomb, shook their homes, clashing and crashing and rattling bones. Rail cars jumbled in giant metal piles, while the flames' black smoke could be seen for miles. Another blast outside, bent and burned five cars. Vinyl chloride, dioxin poison in the soil, water and air. Fish and minnows floating dead everywhere. Burning throats, coughs, watery eyes. Vomiting, headaches, kids traumatized. Entire community destabilized. Hard-working people once again victimized. Elected representatives, where are you at? Americans are hurting, why don't you act? So many sick from all this toxic waste. Give these people health care, clean up this place. Declare these cancer alleys mass casualty sites. Time for solidarity, time to stand together and fight.
Mike Stout, Stand Up for East Palestine. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thousands of students, faculty, and workers are returning to campuses after the summer break. They continue to fight for an end to the genocide in Gaza and divestment from companies that provide military weapons to Israel. On August 29, 2024, at San Francisco State University, Rami Ibrahim of the Palestinian Youth Movement spoke at a rally of students and faculty and raised the issue of workers and the cost of the war and genocide in Palestine and the U.S.
My name is Rami. I'm an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. We're a transnational grassroots youth-led organization led by Arab and Palestinian youth who have taken full responsibility for our liberation and the liberation of our people back in Palestine. For 10 months and 75 years, our people have endured a suffocating genocide. Students all over Gaza have not been able to attend their classes and learn in the ways in which they love to do. Every school in Gaza has been destroyed or has been turned into a shelter for displaced Palestinians. And for months, students here at SFSU and across the Bay Area have been tirelessly fighting to turn their universities away from bankrolling this Israeli genocide and occupation. This summer, SF State has divested from the war manufacturers that have made this genocide a reality. Under the conditions of genocide, this is not a victory, but it is a moral imperative. It is clearer than ever that making these wins requires an active role for us to take in the struggle for our collective liberation. The Third World Liberation Front was taken up right here at SFSU and created the first ever College of Ethnic Studies that ignited a fire of student movement around the country. This was done through the joint struggle of working class students and faculty exerting our collective power over the institutions that seek to exploit us. Now, more than ever, we have cultivated a movement on the backs of the struggles that have come before us. The central role that students have to play in our struggle for liberation. We are creating a movement that can never be defeated and requires each and every one of us to assume responsibility for our liberation. This genocide affects each and every one of us. First and foremost, it affects the Palestinian people, who Zionism seeks to destroy. The 17-year-long siege on Gaza, the imprisonment of our mothers, our fathers, and our children, the mass atrocities that we see every single day on our phone screens. But the Palestinian people, the Samud, their steadfastness can never, ever be defeated. The genocide affects us here too. It affects the millions of us in diaspora who have families back home, in the West Bank, in Gaza, in 1948 borders, in the refugee camps. It also affects us here in the belly of the beast. Every time a bomb drops in Gaza, that is being bought and paid for with our tax dollars. Every time a family is rendered homeless in Gaza, it is being bought and paid for off of the backs of the working classes here. Our streets are filled with people without homes. Students are hundreds and thousands of dollars in debt for pursuing their passions and their education. People are unable to afford going to the hospital for even the smallest issues that become life or death issues. We need to understand that the material conditions for working class students and families here in the West are inextricably tied to the material conditions of Palestinians. Our institutions are wholly responsible for not just allowing this genocide to happen, but for fueling this, for bankrolling this genocide, their blood-soaked endowments, through their pathetic nationwide attempts to repress our students. One by one, each university in the Bay Area has resisted this and will see full and complete divestment from the Zionist entity. In months, SF State has divested from entities responsible for this genocide, and imagine the power that we hold as a community and as a movement to take hold of our futures and demand that every single penny given to Israel is returned back to our communities and not towards the mass slaughter of the Palestinian people. This requires a confrontation. This requires a confrontation between students and their universities, from workers and their employers and their corporations, and from our communities against the empire. We are in the next phase of struggle, a phase that requires us all to become organizers, all of us to fight for our collective futures, to live in freedom and dignity. The Bay Area will tear down the occupation brick by brick. We will tear down US imperialism wall by wall, and we will take the helm of our liberation struggle. Students, do not act in isolation. We are all responsible to organize amongst ourselves. Friends, coworkers, community members, we must continue to fight until each and every one of us is free from Turtle Island to Palestine. Brick by brick, wall by wall, the occupation will fall.
That was Rami Ibrahim at the San Francisco State University rally for Palestine on August the 19th. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of the show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.